from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Dave Iverson. Coming up, the value of wine. A bottle can set you back anywhere from $2 to, well, whatever you're willing to pay. So how do you judge the wine that's right for your palate and your wallet? How is the cost of a wine established anyway? How much of that price can you actually taste? Our guests include a former Bay Area sommelier and wine merchant, the owner of a chain of wine stores in airports throughout the nation, and a wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. Well, depending on your perspective, buying a bottle or even a glass of wine can be fun or an adventure or torture. It can be frustrating and anxiety-producing or instant gratification. In this hour, we're talking about wine, how to order it, how much to pay, when to trust your gut versus the sommelier, and where the interesting off-the-beaten-path wines coming from these days anyway. And we want to know, what are you drinking these days, and what are you thinking when you buy a bottle in a restaurant or in a wine store? Joining us this hour, Debbie Zacharias. She's an owner and partner in a couple of wine stores, the Ferry Plaza Wine Merchant and the Oxbow Wine Merchant in Napa. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And a former sommelier and owner of Bacar.
Yes.
Down. Now, what street was that on?
That was on Brannan Street.
On Brannan, during the dot-com boom. I remember that.
We opened right when it started.
Yes. Also with us in the studio, Doug Tomlinson. He's the CEO of Vinovolo, which is an airport wine bar and shop that you've seen at SFO, and you'll see throughout the country in, what, 26 different locations?
Yeah. We have 26 stores open today.
Good to have you with us. And also, John Bonet is a wine editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. Good to have you as well.
It's a pleasure.
It's a little early in the morning to be talking about wine, but maybe not.
We've gotten used to it.
You've gotten used to it. And, you know, I'm going to open up the phone lines right away because I'm sure this is a topic people have a lot of questions and comments about. So if you want to join us earlier in this hour, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And you can also, of course, email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. John, let me begin with you. When you go into a restaurant, you open up that wine list. What do you look for?
I open up that wine list, and I'm usually there for about 30 minutes. You know, it's interesting. The wine list is actually a great barometer of sort of where the heads of the restaurant owners and wine directors are at and what they love, what they're thinking about, how much they're sort of following trends, how much they're interested in exploring on their own. I think the more you know about wine, you can interpret sort of what kind of meal you're going to have, what kind of experience you're going to have.
So give us an example. Like what would you, if you saw something, you'd say, oh, wow, this tells me what?
Sure. So I'll just to pick on one wine list in town, let's take Nopa because I
happen on Divisadero.
On Divisadero because I happen to love that list. And I think one of the things that makes it work is, first of all, you'll notice that the vast majority of wines are priced under $100, a lot of them really under $50 or $60. So that means a bottle that's significant enough that it's you're going to enjoy it. It's going to be a special dinner, but it's not sort of them swinging for the rafters. And then you start
Meaning what in terms of a markup?
Their markups tend to be fair. It's usually, I'd say, about twice retail. Once you start, because folks in the wine business tend to do this, start memorizing the price of everything, you realize that there's some deals out there. But it's a fair markup in sort of the world of restaurant economics. And then you start looking at kind of where their particular interests lie. That one is a good example because, for instance, their wine directors over time have been fascinated by Zinfandel and kind of the old classic style of Zinfandel that really went well with food. They're fascinated by Austrian Italian wine. They're fascinated by some of the less obvious names in Champagne, but not sort of the ones that kind of have become these little cult hits. They've done a really great job of curating. And so, you know, they have, I think, four or five bottles of really good Beaujolais. And so you see that they've taken the time to think about what goes with food, what's of particular interest, and what's going to kind of draw people's attention and make a better experience.
And Debbie Zacharias, as a wine merchant, you must have people coming to you all the time, wanting to sell you or wanting to have you sell their wines. So what do you look for? The stores that you own are not huge stores.
Correct. So what I'm really looking for are wines that are unique and over-deliver for the price point. And I think that's really the main issue for me, is that, you know, in a world filled with wine at all price points, if somebody's giving me $20 or $50 or even $10, I'm trying to find wines that they're going to come back and feel really good about the money that they've spent on that.
And does that steer you in a particular direction? Does it steer you away from California or towards Santa Barbara or like where?
You know, half of our selection is probably American and half is from the rest of the world. So it steers us really to any great wine regions, and we're not really very particular. I mean, I have my own personal favorites. I do love grower-producer Champagne. I love Austrian wines. I love wines from the Rhone Valley. But I think you have to, as a wine person, you need to embrace the entire wine world and give people all different selections and all different price points.
And Doug Tomlinson, you have locations everywhere from what, I think, Vancouver to Texas, Detroit,
we're
Dallas.
We're all over North America.
Yeah. So to what extent do you try? I mean, of course, your customers are coming from all over. They're not necessarily local.
That's true, yeah.
And so how do you think about the wines that you sell?
Well, you know, our philosophy is that wine should be approachable and easy, and that if you drink wine once a year or once a night, you should still really have fun with the experience of picking out a wine. So we try to tailor the list to the local market, but also have a really broad array from entry-level wines, $6 to $7 a glass, all the way up to splurge. It's a special occasion of going on the second honeymoon or some other reason to drink something really great, and really everything in between. Because we really don't believe there are a finite set of wines that everyone must love. We think there's an infinite number of choices out there, and we just want to bring great choices to people so they can discover their own favorites.
And how does the traveler going through SFO differ from one going through, you know, Dallas, or Detroit or Dallas or whatever?
Well, you know, it's been eye-opening being from Northern California as the founder of this company, how sophisticated wine customers are all across the country, but they do have preferences. So we definitely tend to like our Northern California wines. We also are pretty adventurous and will go almost any around the world to try something. If you go to Seattle, you're going to see a huge loyalty to the Washington wine region, to a lesser extent also to Oregon. So it's really tough to sell them something from Napa. And it goes across the country. Texas loves a different set of wines too.
And isn't most states now, John, are producing some kind of wine, aren't they?
All
or
50.
Trying to.
Yeah,
all 50.
I don't know that
Utah.
All 50 are successfully growing grapes that well. But
yeah. And I jokingly said Utah, but you have a store in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, and it's very crowded with happy wine drinkers. You know, who would have thought? But even Utah has a very small and growing wine region. So yeah. It's really exciting to see this as a local craft.
We're talking this hour all about wine, and if you want to join us, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. Debbie, how big a wine list is too big in a restaurant, do you think? Because you see, you go in sometimes and you have like volumes of pages, and then you have like a chalkboard with 12 options. Like, so how do you decide?
It's true. And as a wine geek, sometimes when you open the wine list and there's 50 pages, it can be, you can zone out and forget about who you're dining with and get absorbed with the wine list. And I think what's important in a situation like that is that the wine list is really well organized. Because even in some larger wine lists, I'm able to look at a table of contents and get to what I want really quickly. So I think that's a really hard question to answer because it depends on how focused the wine list and how well organized the wine list is. But I think a really great wine list, if it's, you know, something in the neighborhood of you know, 50 to 200 selections, that's typically really manageable. And for me, what's really important, getting back to John's point about Nopo, which I also really love that wine list, I think that is a wine lover's wine list, and Nopo caters to a lot of locals. But what's really important, for because obviously many, many people from all over are going to go to these restaurants that are really embraced by the locals, is that you have a great sommelier who can guide you through the wine list. So however large the wine list is, sometimes isn't as important as who is representing it. And I know that when I go to really cool places like SPQR that has, you know, all these great wines that I might not know, I'm looking for my peer, that professional, to take me to the places and take me to the wines that I don't know and say, hey, I'm interested in all of these wines. What do you think? And most of those professionals can get to a wine that you love so quickly. And that's what's really important to me.
John Bonin, what do you think makes a great sommelier?
You know,
or a not so great one.
Well, I think what makes a not so great sommelier inevitably is attitude, and you get a fair amount of that. And I think we're seeing, unfortunately, more and more instances where that craft has become a little bit more about sort of the posture. But I think there's still a ton of people who are doing a great job with it. I think San Francisco is sort of blessed with that. SPQR being a good example, where Shelley Lindgren not only has sort of created this amazing wine list of really almost all Italian wine, but even if she's not there, there's always someone in the restaurant who knows that list as well as she does.
And there are more women sommeliers than there used to be.
Absolutely. And I think actually that's particularly valuable because not just for female patrons, but I think for all customers, I think there's an ease that comes where you don't feel like you're going to get into an ego battle over which bottle you're going to choose. And I think that people still have a fear of being shown up at the table, and it's not fair. It's not fair to the customers.
Debbie Zacharias, what's the worst restaurant wine event you ever participated in?
I think the worst wine experience I've had was actually in France, where I was in a Michelin 3-star restaurant, and I insisted to the French male sommelier that the bottle was corked, and he insisted that it wasn't. And
what do you mean it was corked?
Corked is not when a bottle is just open, and it's not necessarily when a bottle is just bad. There's various faults in wine, and one of them is corked. And what that means is that the cork has been infected with a mold called trichloroanisole, or TCA for short. And when the TCA mold gets into the cork, it actually gets into the wine. And if you've ever smelled a wine that didn't just smell old, but smelt sort of musty and wet newspapers or wet cardboard, that wine is faulty, and it has been infected with this mold called TCA. And it not only makes the wine smell kind of musty, but in many cases it flattens out the fruit. It's a really hard thing to decipher sometimes because there are levels of corkiness. So you can open up a bottle of wine and it can really stink of cardboard and you know that it's corked. Or you can just sort of taste it and say, God, there's no fruit in this wine. Something is wrong with it. I'm not really sure what it is, but it doesn't taste very good, which is why a lot of people are going to screw caps and alternate enclosures, because a lot of people don't really know that a wine is necessarily corked. And it even happens among professionals. And so I've sat with professionals in wine judgings, and we've all looked at each other and said, do you think this wine is corked? Maybe it's corked. Let's get another bottle just to make sure. So it really can be a difficult thing to figure out. But
He disagreed with you.
He disagreed with me, and it was a very expensive bottle. And I finally just said, you know what? I will buy another bottle. And if that bottle tastes different, then I'd like a refund for this bottle. And
showdown.
Sure enough, it was.
It was. Yeah. So
and
we apologize.
Were treated very, very well after that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to the phones. Jaime is our first stop in Napa Valley. Good morning. Welcome. Jamie.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. First of all, I want to say a big fan of both Vino Volo, Oxbow, and John's writing. So this is a great conversation. I guess I had two questions for the panel. The first is, you know, I'm a young person. I think I'm relatively young, 31 years old. I spend a lot of my discretionary income on wine. I love going to restaurants with great wine lists. But, you know, a lot of times when I'm out at a restaurant, I especially with younger sommeliers, I think that sometimes the pendulum swung a little too far into the esoteric wines of the world. and, you know, grape varietals that I've never heard of and things that sometimes are a little too esoteric. And so I guess I wanted the panel's opinion on that. And then I guess the second part of the question is, I know there's such a huge push, you know, in Napa Valley and San Francisco and the Bay Area for local products. The menu's chock full of local ingredients, yet you go in there and I don't see, sometimes I never see one local wine on the list, and it just drives me wild. Hmm. So I'd love to hear the opinions on both those questions.
Yeah, there's this whole local food movement that hasn't translated so much, has it, Debbie, to the wine movement? Or has it?
Everybody's wine list is personal. I think that's the interesting thing. A really good wine program, whether it's retail or restaurant, should make people feel comfortable. And that means having a mixture of wines that are both familiar and esoteric. That's always been my goal from back in my Bricard days to what I do now is that some people want to discover new things. And it's always fun and exciting for a sommelier to give somebody something new and interesting that they don't know. But there's plenty of people who want to, you know, look at a wine list or go to a wine store and find something that they know and love. And so I think you need to make sure that you play both parts.
You got to balance it.
And I think on the second part of that things now are so much better than they were 2 or 3 years ago in terms of having local wines in the Bay Area. My favorite example of this is at Out the Door, Charles Fan's restaurant. They have a whole sort of set of wines on tap, which a lot of restaurants do. And they've gone to things like there's one from a winery called Wind Gap that is a grape called Arinto, which sounds obscure but is actually a relatively popular grape in Portugal, kind of their basic white wine.
And that's an up-and-coming producer, isn't it, Portugal?
It is, except this is from Monterey County. Ah. And so they've actually found kind of a local wine. And the most important part of it, and this is really sort of crucial for me, is, you know, the California wine industry has not done a good job of pricing its wines to let people drink them on an everyday basis. And I think the reason it's better now than it was 3 years ago is there's more young winemakers who are out trying to find a way to just make a table wine. And in the case of this particular one, it's kind of a weird grape from a less obvious place, but they found a way to put a glass on the table for $8, which is something at an artisanal level that California until recently had a big problem with.
All right. Jamie, does that respond to your points?
Yeah, no, it did wonderfully. And maybe if I could ask one more follow-up question.
Real
I know
quick.
That for all these guys, this is a huge can of worms. What about the wine lists out there that draw the line in the sand with the alcohol issue? We're above a certain alcohol point and we're not going to put the wine on the list, or that, you know, they've gone towards, hey, we're going to list all the alcohols, and a lot of the young sommeliers say, well, if you're above a certain alcohol percentage, we don't like that. So that's my last thing, and I appreciate you taking my call.
You bet. Doug Thompson, is that something you think about?
Well, it resonates with me. I hate it when people say you're only allowed to drink this kind of wine. I think it's kind of like going into a music store and the record that you want to buy isn't good enough music. We've all met that person at the record store, at the video store, that won't rent you the broad appeal item because they're going to look down on you for it. I love that what we're doing is turning that around for the guest and saying there's no such thing as a bad wine if you love it. There's a lot of great styles out there. You can go really big over the top alcohol, lots of fruit. You can be very subtle, almost you have to squint to see the flavors. And I love that spectrum of wine, and I love that we can let the customer decide which wine they're going to fall in love with.
Debbie Zacharias, what would you add to that? Because California wines are known for having a big alcohol content, aren't they?
It's warmer in California, and we often do get more fruit and more alcohol. But I would also agree that, while every sommelier wants to make their own personal mark, and some sommeliers' mission is to find lower alcohol wines, I wouldn't agree with that being, you know, something that I would impose on a wine drinker. If they want a big 15.9% Zinfandel, then we find the best ones that represent the most amount of balance of fruit and alcohol, and we offer those.
Yeah. John Bonnet, what should someone ask a sommelier or whoever it is, the waiter that comes to the table and asks if you want some wine?
Sure. I think the easiest thing is to say, you know, what really excites you? What have you really enjoyed drinking here? And see what their response is. And admittedly, I have to say I try this from time to time, and sometimes it fails horribly. And that ends up being kind of a tough reflection on where the restaurant I'm in.
Meaning they're just not knowledgeable?
Sometimes that. I think more often you'll see it's sometimes a case of sommelier brain, and sometimes it's just a case of them thinking that they need to impress me or to, you know, sell kind of a big important bottle. I see that happening less. I think you find a really good wine director. They are going to get excited. It doesn't even have to be something esoteric, but it can be, I don't want to say a simple bottle, but kind of an uncomplicated wine. It could be a really good Grüner Veltliner from Austria. It could be, you know, a great Grenache from Santa Barbara that just happens to speak to them. And I think you want to draw that out because ultimately they're hopefully doing their job because they want to share that.
And so what about asking, you know, what wine on the list do you think are particularly good values?
I think you can always ask that, and sometimes you'll get a good answer, sometimes not. I think the price part of it is always where people seize up, and I think.
What do you mean?
For years there's been this debate, for instance, over whether you should ever order the cheapest bottle on the list. And again, I think it's actually worth, I think, if you're looking at a restaurant, to look at sort of what are their four or five cheapest bottles on their wine list. This is if you can find it online in advance. Take a look at what they are and say, you know, are these people having fun? Are they looking for things to share with their customers, or are they just sort of filling out the bottom of the heap?
And Debbie Zacharias, that question of price. I mean, if you're with a group, especially if it's people you don't necessarily know that well, maybe you want to impress them, maybe you don't want them to know you're on a budget. I mean, to what extent should you just tell the sommelier or the waiter, look, I'm looking for a $40 bottle of wine, or something between $40 and $60, or what? You know, you have to be specific.
I think this is a huge issue because I really think that any customer and any retailer and any sommelier should actually be comfortable talking about price. And I think there's nothing wrong with a customer in a retail store or in a restaurant, you know, starting off by saying, this is the price point that I'm looking at. What would you suggest? Because really, you know, we do have a price point in mind when we go into a restaurant, whether we're sommeliers or just normal consumers, we have an idea of what we want to spend. And I think as much information as a customer can give the professional, it's really helpful. Even if it's a picture on your phone, you know, I've enjoyed these wines. If you can't remember what they are, keep a tab, you know, on your phone of different wines that you like and what the price point is. And if you're a little shy about wanting to actually say what a price point is because you're with, you know, guests and you don't want to actually verbalize that you know, look at a wine list and point to a few wines that you like and say, hey, I'm thinking about this. And then you kind of have sort of given an unwritten communication of what that price point is, and a smart sommelier will be able to kind of look in that price point and make some recommendations for you.
And in terms of value, Doug, I'll start with you. What bottle, half bottle, glass? Like what is there a rule about that? I mean, I'm sure, you know, everyone.
In terms of value, value is a funny thing with wine, right? Because it's just grapes grown in a yard and you turn it into this fantastic product. So how much is it worth? It really depends on how much you fall in love with it. So I think the best value is actually to go, if they have a great program, and we try to do that at Vino Volo, go for a tasting flight or a wine by the glass, because then you get to discover all kinds of wines that night, not just be locked in on one bottle. If you really feel you know your way around a wine list, or you can trust a sommelier not to steer you to the high margin items, which sometimes they will do, then you can try to find value in the bottle. But I do think the value is really in making that experience fun and personal, and the tasting flight gets you there.
John, what would you say?
Not to be contrarian, I think the order you gave is the right one, bottle, half bottle, glass. Not that by the glass programs can't be really interesting and they can be a great introduction. They are almost never a great value. I think especially if you're, say, in San Francisco, you know, you can roll the dice on a bottle you know, worst case, you take it home and you have it the next day. I will say, though, in terms of value, and I'll actually put a number out there, I think that pretty much any restaurant should have a workable selection for folks that's $50 or less, that are really not just kind of being there for, you know, for the sake of people who don't want to spend more, but are serious, interesting wines. And my great case study for this is Cotonia down in Jackson Square.
Every bottle is $40.
Every bottle is $40.
Yeah, very good. All right, John Bonnet from The Chronicle. He'll be with us for the rest of the hour, as will the other guests. We're talking wine this hour on Forum. If you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786. I should say wine and sparkling wine, champagne, too. We haven't talked about that yet. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. Stick around. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this Friday morning. And we're talking wine this hour. And our guests are Debbie Zacharias. She's the owner and partner with Ferry Plaza Wine Merchant and Oxbow Wine Merchant up in Napa. Doug Tomlinson is the CEO of Vino Volo, those airport wine bars you may have seen at SFO and across the country and up in Vancouver, I believe, as well.
That's right.
And John Bonet, a wine editor with the San Francisco Chronicle. The number to call, as I said, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones. Tim is on the line in San Rafael. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm in the wine business myself, and I was anxious to call in and make a plea for a little bit less talk about wine anxiety and the whole concept where, you know, a lot of wine journalism and even the, you know, sort of the lead-in for this show was sort of presupposing that consumers need to be afraid about ordering wine or buying wine in a store. And I know I've done some time in retail, and I spend a lot of time in retail sort of calming customers down who come in with anxiety. And I appreciate that there is, you know, that some people are not familiar with wine, but I think that ordering wine in a restaurant or buying wine in a store is just like ordering food or buying food. You may not know as much about it as somebody else, but you just try it. And that's basically what I had to say.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for the call. John Bonet, there is a lot of anxiety around it, though. Some of it's induced by the setting, but what is it?
There is. I would say to Tim, right on. I mean, it's I think that it's still kind of a new culture, and I think really it's only been the past few years that American wine culture has maybe matured a little bit. But it's interesting. Constellation, which, you know, one of the world's biggest wine companies, did a bunch of consumer research, and they found the vast majority of people who are shopping for wine are either sort of terrified or fearful or just too worn out from the process. And for me, the problem with that is that it gravitates people to wine that aren't terribly interesting, to kind of industrially made wines, and not to pick on Whole Foods, but you have what I kind of tend to call the Whole Foods exception, where you'll see people who will be so finicky about the beef they're buying or the chicken or the broccoli, whatever, and then they kind of get to the wine aisle and they just grab the thing that looks vaguely familiar and they walk off. And I think that it's a problem both at retail often, but also kind of across the industry where rather than people being excited, and you should be excited, we live in probably the greatest time ever to be drinking wine, people are scared and they feel like there's not education. And I agree. I think that a lot of writers don't do much to sort of get people excited rather than sort of creating this sense of fear.
Well, and John and Doug and Debbie in particular, it's in your interest as people who sell wine to have people very comfortable with the idea of it. So, you know, what do you do to facilitate that, Doug?
Well, you know, I think our business is really thriving on the fact that people actually hate ordering wine in restaurants for the most part. And I don't ask wine industry people if customers are happy. I ask our customers. And I hear this over and over again. It's right in line with the Constellation report that, you know, I wish I was in the wine industry because then I wouldn't feel like an idiot every time I get a wine list. And the truth about wine that I think most customers aren't given is that there are, by some estimates, over 200,000 wine selections available today that you could open theoretically if you got your hands on a bottle. So imagine trying to memorize that many SKUs. It's absolutely an impossible task. It's like trying to go into a library and pick out a book based on the titles alone, and somehow you're at fault because you haven't read every book in the library. And so I think what we need to do, and what Vino Volo is really trying to do, is to make the experience more pleasant by not going in with that expectation that you actually are going to know all of these wines, and make the list more approachable, arm your team with really great stories about the wine to make them more human, more interesting, and make the discovery and the fact that you don't know about these bottles not only okay, but actually one of the great things about wine, that it's actually a book you haven't read yet, and this is going to be really fun.
Debbie, what do you do in your store to make it more accessible?
I think you have to begin by creating an environment that is immediately more accessible and more open. I started selling wine retail in 1991 at the Ashbury Market, and so 20 years I've been on a retail floor, and I'm still on a retail floor, you know, handing people bottles of wine and talking to them about it. And what I've discovered in the last 20 years is that I think customers have come a long way. Now, maybe I'm living in my own little San Francisco bubble. I mean, working in the Ferry Building, you tend to have more food and wine savvy people. So While we're getting a lot of tourists, I have to say that my experience with most of our customers is that they walk in and they're immediately willing to have a dialogue and give me immediately what they're looking for, what kind of price point they're looking for, region, what they're eating, if they've picked up food in the store. So I think being more proactive and starting off by making somebody feel comfortable means that you have initiated a dialogue. And in the 20 plus years that I've sold wine, I've never sold it, sorry, John, on a third party review or, you know, there's no points, there's no stars, there's no puffs, there's nothing lying around the store that I think sometimes intimidates people because, you know, 95 points, if you give somebody a wine that somebody's rated 95 points, then what you're saying to a consumer is you're supposed to like this wine because it's 95 points. And what I discovered when I read 95 point scores when I was in my early 20s studying about wine is that, wow, I don't think that wine is 95 points. I don't agree with that.
Well, and of course, it is very subjective.
Wine is completely subjective.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Mark is on the line in Burlingame. Welcome.
Yes, I'd like to have some information about nomenclature on a wine bottle. I know there's specific meaning behind produced and bottled, invented and bottled, as to where the grapes come from or the percentage coming from the property, et cetera. So if you could elucidate that, I think that would be very helpful.
John Bonet?
Sure. I think there's all sorts of terms, and we could spend our lifetimes trying to decode wine bottles, especially ones from Germany. but estate bottled generally means that the wine has come from, and it's a little bit of a misnomer, which I blame the federal government for, that the wine has come from vineyards that are under the viticultural control of a winery. And if you can figure out what that means, then you're way ahead of most of the alcohol lawyers in the country. But it sort of means theoretically that they control the farming or in some way control the vineyard. Beyond that, in terms of the appellation, the area where it came from in the U.S., it's typically 85%. 85% of the grapes have to have come from
Napa or Sonoma.
Exactly.
That's what they
say. You know, it's amazing how much fudge, you get on that 15%.
How so?
Well, let's say you're drinking Napa Valley in air quotes, Sauvignon Blanc. It is an entirely reasonable proposition that other portion probably came from Lake County, only because, you know, everyone's got to pay the bills and that's how you kind of cover your margins, is to go somewhere where the grapes are a little less expensive. And then finally, just in terms of variety name, it's a 75% rule. So whatever the grape name, if it's on the bottle, and I should sort of put my little disclaimer. Having a varietal name in no way necessarily means that a wine is better than a blend. I think that was one of those kind of 70s and 80s beliefs that got entrenched. But if people are looking for that, it means 3/4 of the grapes are in fact that grape.
Debbie, what would you add in terms of labels? What to look for? It sounds like there's not much continuity. It depends on where it's from and what the rules are, whether it's the European Union or the U.S. or Mexico.
It really does depend on where it's from. And I think sometimes it's really hard trying to teach somebody how to read a wine label. So I understand the caller's frustration entirely because, what you're supposed to know about the way French wines are labeled are entirely different than how Californian wines are labeled. And, you know, there's wines from all over Italy that sometimes have the grape varieties on them. And you're supposed to know that, you know, Sangiovese is grown in Tuscany, so therefore if you're getting a Chianti, which is grown in Tuscany, it's going to be Sangiovese-based. And I think it is, unfortunately, really confusing to read labels sometimes.
Yeah. All right. Mark, thanks for the call. Hope that was helpful. A couple of you have mentioned Austria. What are some other areas? I just alluded to Mexico. I was in Mexico a few weeks ago and was surprised. There are some pretty good Mexican wines. I think they're mostly grown in Baja. But where would you say, aside from Austria?
I think one of the earlier callers' questions about local wines is very real. So I think wine is about storytelling. It's about understanding a sense of place and about flavor, kind of like watching a movie is about much more than the plot. And so I think if you want to discover a new region, go for it. There really are a boundless number of regions you can try. Most of you can't get your hands on in any particular store. So what we try to do is really give you that local flavor when you go to that location. So most of our guests have never tried Leland Isle Peninsula whites from Michigan State, which are actually quite good. And if you're stuck for whatever reason, in the Delta hub of the Detroit airport, you know, you get a chance to try one. Same thing for Hill Country in Texas. We're opening in Cincinnati in a few months, and we'll even have wines, believe it or not, from Kentucky. And I'm not promising you it's going to be the best wine you've ever had, but it's probably not going to be the worst either. And really just being able to add that to your set of experiences is what wine, I think, is all about.
Debbie, what would you add in terms of value and just interesting?
Yeah, there are regions throughout the country that are really great. I love some of the Rieslings that are coming out of New York. There's some great Pinot Noir coming from Long Island. I think that some regions have come into favor and also have come out of favor. And, you know, for instance, Australia is a really tough one. There used to be, you know, lots of Australian Shiraz in the marketplace, and you barely see it anymore.
Why is that?
I think that a lot of them tasted like each other, and it got to the point where if you had, you know, 7 Australian Shirazes all on the same price point on your wine list or on the shelves, it was hard to decipher one from another. I'm seeing that a little bit with Argentinian Malbec. I'm finding that a few carefully selected wines from certain regions are sort of all you need. And then you do find places like Austria and, you know, regions in Italy that there's so much diversity and there are so many different styles of wines and different price points that you tend to get more excited about some of the diversity.
John, what about Mexico?
The hard part with, and supposedly the Guadalupe Valley is honestly just finding the wines. But yeah, there's lovely wines out of there, and it's worth sort of noting. These days trying to find more things to enjoy about kind of what's emerging in California. You know, San Diego County, which I think no one ever thought of as a place that would be wine country, has really a few really super interesting wines. So if you look at Baja and kind of continuing across the border, there's no reason in the world that there shouldn't be very good wine grown in Southern California down into Baja.
And Temecula is a big wine region. I don't know if that's Riverside or San Diego, but it's...
Temecula's issues are more sort of aesthetic than anything else. A lot of limousines and a lot of almond champagne flowing.
Okay. Back to the phones. Let's see. Where are we? Leslie in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. What a wonderful program you have. I'd like to make a comment as to my experience out there as a consumer. And what I look for is the pairing of food and wines. And so I tend to order flights and small bites and compare the pairing with each. And what I'm most interested in is the education. I'm not professional. Wine merchant or anything, but I'm constantly looking for learning more about the wine, where it's from, the terroir, and so forth. What's very nice in San Francisco is being able to go into a wine bar and find a sommelier that will speak to the regions and explain how the grapes are grown. It's the evening turns into almost a lecture. My favorite is Nectar, and Chris Potter is very good at explaining to all of his customers where the grapes are. All you have to do is ask for.
And John Bonnet, is a restaurant really the right place, do you think? You want to learn enough to order intelligently, but you'll see sometimes in wine stores they'll have tastings.
Wine stores are fantastic. To do that, but this is if you're in a wine bar and it's not busy, then it becomes appropriate to ask questions. Obviously, you're not going
right.
to try to corral someone.
John Bonnet, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think that depends on the restaurant and depends on who you're with. I don't think you necessarily want to go through a flight of wine if you're going to bore your date to death. I think that you should absolutely tap into it, and I think it is the right place to ask questions. And I think that you can find there's lots of places throughout the Bay Area where, again, you know, sommeliers buy wine because they love it and they want to share it. Good sommeliers, of which there are many. And so, tap into that. It's a fantastic resource, and you're paying them anyway, so you might as well get something extra for your money.
Leslie, thanks very much for the call. Doug was talking about Texas and Michigan. What about the East Bay? Debbie. I know I've been up in Lodi. They're very proud of their wine industry there. What do you think about the outer parts of Alameda County?
I think that, again, there's a lot of new regions that are not the classic Napa-Sonoma Valley and some really talented individuals who are going into some of these other regions and are making a much greater mark than there used to be just sort of, you know, mediocre kind of mass-produced wines there. And people are discovering some really great vineyards. Some old vines, Zinfandels, and, you know, the greater the quality is in the growing places, the greater the talent there is that are going after some of those regions. And so you're seeing an amazing increase in quality in places that you never even thought about 10 years ago.
John Bonnet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're discovering now is that California really does have, and has honestly for well more than a century, has extraordinary range in the places that it can grow wine. It could be eastern Lodi, it could be all sorts of things. And what it's needed, and I think what it's starting to get, is really good winemaking talent that doesn't just want to make the same old wine that we've kind of been seeing for the past 20 years, but that wants to actually show us what the terroir of California can do. And I think that is the single biggest thing that the industry can give to us in California, is to really understand what a bounty is here and how diverse it is.
All right, we got a lot of emails, so let me read a few of those. Ruth says, what would be a good low-cost wine but presentable for a party around $10? Debbie? You're grimacing.
Well, we have a 12 and under section at the Ferry Plaza Wine Merchant. So you walk in the door and the first thing you see are, you know, 30 or so selections at $12 and under. From California, one of my favorite producers is Heron. They do a Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot, Chardonnay, and Cabernet that are all, you know, under $12. Stephen Vincent also does some great wines under $12 from California. One of my favorites is the Colby Red made by Daryl Groom, who is been a spectacular winemaker in California. And that wine is named after his son, and a fair amount of the money, I think all of the profits, actually go back to a charity for heart research.
Is there a point, either Debbie or any of you, really, that you said 12, not 10? I mean, is there a point at which, you know, when you get below a certain point, you're really going to sacrifice?
Well, this section used to be 10 and under until wine got more expensive, and then we decided that 12 and under was a better price point. There are a fair amount of wines under 10 in that section as well. So I think, you know, $8 to $12, if, you know, I like to tell people that a bargain isn't a bargain if you're going to pour it down the drain. So there's nothing wrong with finding a great $10 bottle of wine. But my suggestion is to make sure that you
like it,
that you like it, and that it helps to purchase it from any establishment where you know they're really tasting through all of the wines and finding the best wine for that money.
John?
I think $10 can be hard. I think what you run into the risk of there is a lot of sort of, again, industrially made wine. And to me, the joy of wine is buying something that's not necessarily sort of on a supermarket shelf that looks like everything else. I think it tends to mean if you want to be around there, you're probably going to more often than not look overseas, more often than not look to white wine. But I think there's great opportunity there, not to sort of stick with Austria and Portugal. But I think if you look at Portuguese Vinho Verde, which is usually $9 or so a bottle and has just a tiny little bit of spritz, it's really one of the most fun wines imaginable you could open for a party.
All right, here's another email. Matt writes, I really like sour beers, often aged in wine barrels. What sorts of wines should I seek out based on that flavor profile of sour beers that are spontaneously fermented? Anybody?
I might send them to Italy, get some sour cherry flavors out of a Sangiovese that's been sitting on oak. They'll be reminding him of the oak barrels.
Yeah.
But I would say drink beer for beer's sake and wine for wine's sake. Go try 6 different wines you haven't tried before, and you'll get a better answer than I can give you.
And I'll throw Amontillado Sherry in there just for her.
Okay, good. Here's another email from Ken in Livermore. I live in Livermore, and I'm happy to be close to a wine-producing region. My wife and I have been enjoying wines in the Lodi area recently. We love the Zins, Barberas, and Sangioveses. Why do the Italian grapes thrive so well in this area? Is it climate, soils, both? Debbie?
That's an interesting question. I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth. Those varieties are planted more in that area, and I think what we have seen a lot in California is people becoming more in tune with what grows well in certain areas. There used to be a whole lot more Chardonnay grown in Napa Valley until people realized that it wasn't the right climate for it. So you are seeing very specifically grape varietals matched with regions and their climates. John, you might know more about that than me.
I don't know that I'm going to go on record as saying that those are exactly the right choices for there. But I will say this. I think that if you look at kind of the range of what the old Italian farmers in mostly Northern California, but really all of California, were planting a century ago, the Zinfandels, the Barberas, the Montepulciano's and Carignans and all the sort of stuff that went into the old field blends. One reason they did it is because those varieties thrive in heat. And so somewhere that there's a fair amount of heat, if you farm them right, you can make a pretty great table wine.
Here's another comment. I'm a huge wine, red wine fan, but tend not to eat much meat or rich foods. I eat pretty healthy. Should I stick with my red or order a white because it would match the food better, or maybe forego wine altogether? No, not that. John?
I think a lot of folks tend to think they're white wine people or red wine people, and I think it's worth always exploring. And I am going to put an extra plug in for rosé, so you can split the difference.
Yeah, we haven't talked about rosé. That's they're sort of getting new credibility, or have been for years, really. Debbie, huh?
Rosé is a huge category for me. Of course, you know, in the summer months, it's a little bit greater than in the winter months, but, you know, we don't really have a very cold climate in California, so we drink rosé all year long. And to me, it's as serious of a wine or as fun of a wine as many others. And I'm a huge proponent of rosé, but I'm also a huge proponent of not necessarily being stuck in your ways with, you know, red wines or white wines. And a lot of it depends on the sauces and the preparations and the accompaniments on a plate. So there's really those hard rules are meant to be broken. And I have traveled places where there might be white wine regions, in particular in Germany, where I'm drinking a lot of German wine with boiled beef. And it opens your eyes that there's a lot of great pairings that are not necessarily red wine with meat, white wine with fish. So
sure, yeah, Doug, yeah,
I absolutely agree with Debbie that the emailer shouldn't feel bad or be made to feel bad for having a fantastic evening with fish and one of her favorite or his favorite red wines on the table. If you like it, it's a perfect pairing. And I'm tired of people lecturing somebody on whether or not they're allowed to like something. It's ridiculous. The customer is the only person right in the room.
And I think the one thing with something like, say, fish and red wine, there's a lot of red wines now that are much lighter in style than people tend to think of them. And so
what beside Pinot would you say?
I mean, you could go to Beaujolais, but I would say something like Grignolino or Schiava from northern Italy, for instance, which are – they're barely red. I mean, they sort of look like a dark rosé, and they're not tannic. They're very fresh. They almost function more like a white wine, and there are frankly fish that probably would go way better with them than they would with many white wines.
And are they used for blending or they're
– No. They're just – if you're up in the Alps, you're not going to have much luck with a big, deep red wine.
Yeah. Debbie, do you sell those?
We do sell those, and I think Mondeuse is another fun one. I mean, if you find these really fruity reds, often if you have a dish that has a fair amount of sweet flavors in it and fruity flavors, you want to find a fruity wine. So, you know, lower in tannins and higher in fruit and lighter in alcohol, those wines are really great.
Another listener question. I was treated to a very expensive dinner for Christmas. We ordered the chef's tasting menu and the matching wine tasting, a new wine with every course. It was so much liquid. Was I not supposed to finish each glass? Do people who regularly go to those kind of dinners only taste each wine? I don't think there's necessarily a rule for that.
John? You're paying money for the wine, you should be able to drink all of it.
Yeah, and the tastings are often smaller. They're not a full class.
Yeah, I think it's good advice to ask when you're doing a tasting menu how many courses there will be so that you can pace yourself on the amount of wine you're going to have with each course, because it would be a shame to realize you capped out and you're only halfway through the meal. So that would be my tip.
Yeah.
And that's from making the wrong choice myself. So now I always ask.
You know, we talked earlier about, it was you, Debbie, talking about your experience in France with the corked wine. What's the right time to send, when do you send a wine back? John, what's your rule?
My rule is a hard one to apply because I have sort of – I know exactly whether, you know, whether something isn't as it should be. And I think it's hard. I think if something immediately strikes you as wrong, like Debbie said, if the wine is obviously corked, it smells like wet dog or wet cardboard or something, clearly send it back. And honestly, even if the wine is not technically flawed, if it really is that far off and they didn't say something to you in advance, I think you're well within your rights to say, you know what, I'm not sure why you're serving me this and just expecting me to kind of dig it.
Yeah. What if if the waiter or the sommelier recommend it and you just don't like it?
I think if you're spending a fair amount of money on wine, which you often are in a restaurant, you should be able to feel comfortable enough. And I know it's a really uncomfortable place to be to say, I don't like it, something is
especially
wrong with it.
Especially if it's a bottle.
Absolutely. But I think it's really important to be able to not suffer. You shouldn't have to suffer your way through a bottle of wine in a restaurant. So I think it is important immediately to, you know, look at the server and say, there's something I don't like about this. There's something off about it. And make sure that either the server or a manager or somebody actually can get to that bottle and taste it. And a good professional isn't going to make you feel bad about the fact that you don't like it and get you something that you do like.
Right, and one way I think that I've sort of gone at this and saving face for everyone is to basically say, could you just taste this for me, make sure this bottle's okay? And then if there's something wrong, that gives them an out, and if it's really okay, then they know you don't like it.
You know, there's a trend, it seems, at least in Bay Area restaurants, where it's okay to ask for a taste of the wine. You know, and sometimes a waiter will bring, well, it's between these two wines, I'll bring you a taste of both. So when is that okay? Is there too much of that? Well, restaurants or waiters, I would think it must be a pain to a certain extent for them. On the other hand, it may lead to them, you know, selling some glasses of wine. I mean, what are your thoughts about that, Debbie?
Well, we have a wine bar, so it's a great vehicle for me. Even when customers come into the store and they're trying to figure out what they want to buy, I'll bring them over to the bar and I'll give them a few tastes. I think within reason, you know, I think a server can actually offer, hey, let me have you taste a couple of things that we have by the glass so I have a better idea of what you're looking for, and then they can give you a bottle accordingly.
Yeah, John, what do you think about that? Is that perfectly?
I think as long as it's within good faith, it's completely all right any time. You know, I mean, servers are in some ways as scared as we are when we're there because they also don't want to serve you something that you really hate.
All right. Thanks to all of you this hour. A great conversation about wine. John Bonnet from the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks to you for being here. Thanks also to Doug Tomlinson, CEO of Vino Volo, the airport wine bars. And Debbie Zacharias from Ferry Plaza Wine Merchant and Oxbow Wine Merchant up in Napa. Thanks so much. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Nora McCartan, Lauren Beneshu, Jasmine Wynn, and Stefan Norgard. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.